The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
Hello, and welcome once again to What's Your Story? My guest this time is Chris Sentner, who is the curator of the Edgar Allan Poe Museum in Richmond. And Chris, we start this program with the same question we always start with, and that is, what's your earliest childhood memory?
Well, I remember being in a crib and looking up at the ceiling and crying, and the mother came into the room and she picked me up and fed me, and I just remember thinking, that's not what I was asking for. I wasn't hungry.
Do you remember what you wanted?
I think I was just cranky because I'd just woken up, but I was still a baby, so I couldn't communicate that.
How old do you think you were?
Maybe I was a year old.
Wow. That's impressive. Where was this?
This was in Blackstone, down in Southern Virginia.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Virginia?
Yes.
Did you stay in Blackstone very long?
Yeah, I stayed there until I went to college.
And you went to college where?
I started out at VCU up in Richmond, and then I went up to Philadelphia to the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts.
And studied?
Painting.
Painting?
Yes.
And do you still keep it up?
Yeah, I still keep it up, and I still show regularly.
Well, good for you. Has it been a thread throughout your life? Did you always know you wanted to do something artistically expressive?
Yeah, but growing up, I didn't really know what an artist was. We didn't have artists in Blackstone, and we didn't have any art around. There weren't any art museums there, but I knew I enjoyed drawing. And the closest thing I had to art was my parents had black velvet painting of some roses.
Uh-huh.
And I remembered how, if you look closely at those rose petals, they look like a dog's head. So I imagined that the roses were dog's heads barking at each other. And then our neighbor was just a nice little old lady, lived alone, and she had this really nice oil painting of an ocean scene. And there were waves crashing against the rocks. And I remember how those rocks in the foreground looked like big dog's heads.
Huh.
So I grew up really liking that way that art had all these hidden images and then all these hidden meanings. And it really opened pathways to imagination.
And after studying in college, you came back to Virginia?
Yeah, I came back to Virginia. I liked the climate and the people and the variety of restaurants. And the pizza in Richmond was a lot better than in Philadelphia.
Really?
Yeah. Bottoms up pizza, the best pizza in the world.
As
far as I know.
Interesting. We could do a whole show on what the best pizza in Richmond is. When you came back to Richmond, what did you do? Or when you came to Richmond, what did you do?
When I came to Richmond, I had been doing my assistantship at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, so I wanted to go into museum work when I got back to Richmond. And it took a little while. I started out working the night shift, making stained glass, and then after a year of that, I got a job at the Poe Museum. Mm-hmm. And they were in need of someone who could be a tour guide, and I'd ridden tours at the Philadelphia Museum. They also needed someone with an artistic background who could do some restoration work on a model of Richmond they had. They'd been damaged in a fire. We have an 18-foot-long scale model of 1840s Richmond here. It was made back in the 1920s, and about 1999 it was damaged in a fire, and they needed someone who could come in and clean it and restore it. But they couldn't afford a full restoration, so they had a conservator work with me and advise me and tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I spent about 6 months working on that.
And what was the path from there to being the full curator of the museum?
Gradually over time people would retire, so you just gradually move up.
What attracted, did something attract you to Poe, or was this a job when you first started?
No, I'd liked Poe's work since I was probably in about fifth grade, and the librarian at our school read the story to us. Mm-hmm. And they start out with comic pieces. So my first exposure to Poe was his dark sense of humor. They read stories like Hop Frog and Never Bet the Devil Your Head.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up, you know, getting a good chuckle out of some of Poe's stories. And some of his stories are actually pretty funny up until somebody gets set on fire or get their head chopped off and ruins the mood after that. But until then, they're pretty funny stories. Even The Cask of Amontillado has a lot of humor and irony in it. Mm-hmm. So they started out me on the comedy, and then I worked my way up to the horror, like The Telltale Heart.
Did you like him right away, or was it an acquired taste?
I liked him right away. He's one of those authors that when kids are in school, they read and they want to read more of him. They actually enjoy reading him. You sort of struggle your way through a lot of the other authors and you find them kind of boring. But Poe's one of the first authors that students really enjoy reading and want to read more. And that's why the Poe Museum is so popular among the school groups.
Mm-hmm. We are, set the scene for us. Where are we right now?
We are right now in the Raven Room in the Exhibits Building of Edgar Allan Poe Museum down at 20th and East Main in Shaco Bottom.
And it's the, a lot of Richmonders just know it as the Old Stone House. Is it the oldest stone house in the city?
Well, the museum actually has four buildings in all, and the entrance is through a little stone house. And it's the oldest house still standing in the original city limits of Richmond. So mm-hmm. as Richmond grew, there's other houses that are older than it, but for a long time this was the oldest house still standing in Richmond. It's still the only pre-Revolutionary War house still standing in downtown Richmond. And based on testing of the tree rings and the floorboards, they dated it to at least about 1754. Mm-hmm. So it was built well before the Revolution. But for a long time there were rumors that it was dated even back to 1607. We just acquired an old guidebook that they used to sell at the house back in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. So you could pay 5 cents and get this little book, and they told you that Chief Powhatan actually built the house in 1607.
Really?
And they would tell you that Pocahontas got married here. They told you that George Washington used it as headquarters. They used to have a big sign outside that said Washington's headquarters.
How much credence do you put in that?
Absolutely none. Washington wasn't even here during the Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So then they changed the sign at one point that said Washington and Lafayette's headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
But it, over the years, was used as a curio shop, an antique shop, after the last family moved out. But it stayed in the same family's possession from at least 1754 until 1911.
Do we know if Poe himself was ever in this house?
He probably would have stood outside. It was 1824, the Marquis de Lafayette was making his return visit to America, and Poe was on the honor guard that escorted Lafayette around town. And when Lafayette was here, he's said to have visited the house, and Poe would have been standing outside while Lafayette was inside getting all the attention. Apparently this family inside had helped supply Lafayette's troops during the Revolution, and he was paying them a visit and thanking them for all their help. He picked up their boy, who was about 2 years old, and the family was so proud that Lafayette had touched their boy, they changed the boy's name to Lafayette.
How did it come into possession of the Poe Museum? Or when did it become the Poe Museum?
The Poe Museum opened in 1922, so there's a little bit of gap there. About 1913, the other buildings in this block were demolished, and the Granville Valentine saved the house from destruction. He gave it to the Association for the Preservation of Virginia Antiquities, which is now Preservation Virginia. And they tried to find someone to rent it or take care of it. And there was an antique store here for a while, but the owner left because people kept vandalizing the property. There's a junkyard out back. And a fellow named Archer Jones and his wife decided they wanted to save it because it was a colonial-era building in downtown Richmond. It was one of these last remainders of what an average person's home looked like during the Revolution. Is one of these nice plantations that you see on the James River. It's a nice, modest house, and they thought they would make have a nice colonial-era history museum here. And they got in touch with a fellow named James Whitty, and Whitty was a Poe collector. He had the world's largest collection of Poeana, and he'd been studying Poe. In 1906, he was on a committee that was trying to build a Poe statue for Monument Avenue. And the city didn't really want it. They offered to give matching funds, but the Poe Society couldn't raise enough money to get this statue built. The newspaper at the time said that Poe wrote some nice poetry, but his character wasn't worthy of being remembered, so they weren't going to get a statue just yet. So then this Poe group decided they wanted to save the office where Poe got his start in journalism. It was at 15th and Main Street.
Mm-hmm. Not far from here.
Yeah, not far from here at all. And this was a time when the homes of political figures and military figures had been preserved, but Richmond hadn't really honored its cultural figures, its writers, and its artists. So this was really unusual for the time. And they wanted to save the office and use it as an international Poe museum. But then in 1916, the city condemned the building and demolished it.
Mm.
So they had a pile of bricks.
Mm-hmm.
But James Whitty spoke to Mr. and Mrs. Archer Jones about bringing the bricks here and building a garden as a memorial to Poe. So they took the bricks, the granite, the lumber. They made 11 bookcases out of lumber. They restored the old stone house using locks and doorknobs and hinges and lumber saved from the office building, and they landscaped a whole garden, and they based the garden on Poe's poetry. So the whole layout came from his poem, "To One in Paradise." The lines, "A green isle and the sea love, a fountain and a shrine, all wreathed in fairy fruits and flowers, and all the flower and all the flowers are mine."
Now, is this the garden that we just walked through?
Yeah,
the
garden. We just walked through there.
Okay.
And that opened.
It's a lovely space.
Yeah, it opened April 1922 and got international attention. Raphael Tuck and Sons, who were the official printmakers for the Queen, did postcards of it. So there's little oil-painted postcards that they made. And we had H.P. Lovecraft and Gertrude Stein and a lot of other cultural figures visit the museum in the early years. And the governor attended the opening. They invited the president, but he turned them down.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was a little too busy.
Poe was born in 1809?
Yes.
Lived to 1849.
Yes.
Died young.
Yeah, died at 40.
What is Richmond's... He wasn't born here. He was born in Boston?
Yeah, he was born in Boston. He came to Richmond.
What is his claim to fame? Why does Richmond claim Poe for its own?
Oh, because Poe claimed Richmond.
Huh?
He famously said in one of his letters, "I am a Virginian, because I have spent all my life until the last few years in Richmond."
Mm-hmm.
So he grew up in Richmond. He was orphaned here, taken in by foster parents John and Frances Allen, who gave him the middle name of Allen.
Mm-hmm.
He got his first job in journalism here. He met his first love here, wrote his first poetry, wrote his only novel here, wrote his only play.
Mm-hmm.
He was married here in a little boarding house that stood not far from the state capitol.
His mother was from here, correct?
His mother was from England, and she came to the States when she was 9 years old back in 1796. And she made her debut in Boston. This was about 3 years after they legalized ACT in the city of Boston.
Huh.
And she traveled up and down the coast between Portland, Maine, and Charleston, South Carolina, and Richmond was one of her stops. But she actually married Poe's father right here in Richmond at the old Henrico County Courthouse that used to stand a few blocks down the street.
Down the street from where we are. And she is buried at St. John's Church?
Yeah, she's buried at St. John's. And okay. You can find her monument off on the east side of the cemetery against the wall. Apparently since she was an actress, they didn't really want to bury her in a churchyard, so she's way off against the wall there.
Hmm. Times have changed.
Yeah, now actors are celebrities.
Yeah.
In her time, she was pretty famous, so the ladies of Richmond, who usually wouldn't associate with someone like an actress, were actually bringing her meals while she was dying.
Wow.
And she died of tuberculosis when she was 24, and one of these society ladies who had been taking care of her took in Edgar Poe, and another one of the ladies took in Edgar's little sister, Rosalie.
Edgar Poe did not have an easy childhood, right?
Well, it was a bit of an extreme. There's extremes back and forth. He started out in dire poverty. His father abandoned him not long after he was born, and his mother had to fend for herself, take care of three children by herself. Eventually, she had to give up Edgar's older brother and have them live with the Poe grandparents in Baltimore, but she took Edgar and his little sister with her to Richmond, and then she died very early on. So Edgar was taken by foster parents who never legally adopted him. They just took him in, made sure he was properly educated.
These were the Allens.
These were the Allens.
And isn't there some connection with Allen Avenue in Richmond? Isn't that...
It's a different spelling.
Different spelling. So there is no connection.
No.
What part of town did he live in, do we know?
Well, at different times they lived all along the street. So when they first moved from the Allens, he lived about 13th and Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to England for 5 years, and they came back. They lived at 2nd and Franklin, where the public library is, there used to be a little wooden cottage there. It's actually a decent-sized house where Alan's business partner lived, and from there they went to about 5th and Clay Streets, and from there they went to 14th Street, sort of halfway between Main and Franklin. And then from there they moved to 5th and Main Street. And if you go to the corner of 5th and Main Street, on the side of one of the buildings there, on the southeast corner, you'll see a plaque that marks that as the site of one of Poe's boyhood homes.
Mm-hmm. And he went to the University of Virginia briefly.
Yeah, I went to the University of Virginia. He was in the only second year of his existence. He actually went there while Jefferson was still alive. And Jefferson died while Poe was there. Oh. So I don't think Poe actually attended the funeral. At the time, it was this revolutionary new school, and it was the most expensive school in the country, about $350 a year. Mm. But Poe only had $110. He was living with this wealthy tobacco exporter who was worth about $750,000, which would be Donald Trump in today's terms. Oh. But Mr. Allen didn't give Poe enough money for college, so Poe started gambling, and he was about $2,000 in debt after the first 9 months. So he couldn't afford to go back, and he'd have to end his college career after one term. He later did go to West Point, and was at the United States Military Academy at West Point, also for about 8 months. And there he was actually kicked out for gross neglect of duty.
And do you know the specifics?
Yeah, he got to West Point. He was cut off by John Allen and didn't want to stay. He needed Allen's permission as his guardian to resign, but Allen wouldn't give him permission, so he said, if you don't respond to this letter and give me permission to resign, then I will have to get kicked out. So Poe stopped showing up to class, stopped showing up to drill, disobeyed orders, and finally got court-martialed and expelled from West Point. But they liked him enough there that the other cadets chipped in and helped him get a book published. So they actually liked him. It's not as exciting a story as some of the things that came about after he died. So about 20 years after he died, they started spreading the rumor that one of the things Poe did at West Point was cutting the head off a chicken and stuffing the bloody chicken in the canvas sack and carrying the bloody sack and bloody knife, pretending he just killed somebody and chopped off their head. In the 1920s, they actually came up with the story that Poe showed up to drill one day wearing nothing but his socks. So the longer Poe's dead, the more trouble he gets into.
So what did he do after West Point, and after the University of Virginia and then West Point? Did he come back to Richmond?
Well, he told people that after he graduated first in his class at UVA, he took off to Europe and fought the Greek Wars of Independence, but was captured in St. Petersburg, Russia, and was rescued from there. And then he went to London for a couple of years, and then he came back to America. But what actually happened was he went to his aunt's house in Baltimore, and he spent a couple of years there. And he tried to get a job as a school teacher, even applied for a job as a school teacher here in Richmond, but couldn't get hired. And he'd published 3 books of poetry already. He'd self-published the first two, the second one the cadets at West Point paid for. But then he started submitting his short stories to magazines, and he submitted a short story called Mettingerstein, which is just sort of a gothic story about a haunted castle and a family curse. And he didn't win the contest he submitted it to, but they printed his story anyway without paying him, and they probably didn't even tell him. So he got his first story published without him even knowing it. So he started publishing more and more of these stories, any more contests. He entered one called Manuscript Found in a Bottle, about a sea voyage and a man who gets trapped on a ghost ship. And it was kind of an adventure story, and it won a contest. He won $100, which was a lot of money back then. Mm-hmm. And one of the judges for the contest told him there was a new magazine starting in Richmond called the Southern Literary Messenger. Mm-hmm. So Poe moved back to Richmond, and the Messenger was kind of ahead of its time. They thought that America's best writers at the time lived up north. You had Washington Irving and James Fenimore Cooper, and there wasn't a lot going on with Southern literature at the time. So the owner of this magazine decided he wanted to encourage art and literature in the South and show the northern states that the South had just as much culture as they did. So he hired Poe to write some nice stories about Southern life that would educate and entertain the public without offending them. Mm-hmm. So Poe sent Berenice. It's a man The narrator is a man who is so obsessed with his wife's teeth that after she dies, he digs her up and plucks out all her teeth, only later realizing she'd been buried alive. So it got a lot of angry letters and a lot of complaints. Poe almost got fired after that first story, but he told his boss, "Trust me, this is what sells. And you'll know this is a success by looking at the circulation of the magazine." And he did. After 17 months, the circulation increased 7 times as a leading journal in the South, and Poe was starting to get noticed in those northern states. And the next month, he decided to submit another one of his horror stories, but he also submitted a book review. Mm-hmm. And usually book reviews are kind of boring, but Poe submitted a review in which he started by saying the best thing about this book is the bad paper in which it's printed, and then he finished up by advising the author to shoot himself. And Poe thought he was hilarious, and a lot of the readers did, because they kept buying it. They couldn't wait to see what he was going to say about something next. He called Washington Irving the most overrated writer in America. He called James Fenimore Cooper someone who had no understanding of plot, and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's most popular poet in the country. And Poe said he was a little bit quacky himself, but he was followed by a whole legion of literary quacks who had no original ideas. And he said that Longfellow himself wasn't so much good at coming up with new ideas as imitating other writers. So Poe liked to take pot shots at other writers and call them names like toads and quacks and nincompoops, ignoramuses. And he had fun. And at one point, one of Poe's editors actually wrote to Longfellow and told him not to take it personally, that this publicity only helped both of your careers. So Poe may, help both of them. So Poe may not have actually disliked these other writers so much as he knew that was how to attract readers to his magazines. He actually said at one point, "To be appreciated, you must be read." So he realized that people aren't going to appreciate your work if they don't read it. And the way to get them to read your work is to create this kind of publicity and stir up trouble. And he would also have publicity stunts where he would challenge his readers to send him any sort of cryptogram or puzzle or code, and he would solve it. And he was able to solve all but one of them, which he proved was a trick that couldn't be solved.
What was it about his mind that led him to the macabre and the bizarre and these outrageous things that he said? Do you know what the genesis of that was?
Now, we know that he wrote about 69 stories, and about 27 of them were comedies and satires. And he only comparatively wrote fewer horror stories. He wrote a lot of mysteries, and he invented the detective story. Right. So he wrote a wide variety of things and wrote science fiction. So he had a curiosity about everything. He's also reading the newspapers at the time, reading the magazines that are coming over from England, and he was seeing what was popular over there. And he was trying to adapt that to an American audience, so he knew that gothic tales were very popular. And he started out writing this gothic tale, but then later he developed into a modern psychological horror story where he took the horror out of the haunted castle and then took the supernatural out of it and replaced it with insanity and an exploration of the paranoia and the murderous tendencies, or what he called the imp of the perverse, this urge inside to do the wrong thing simply because you know it's the wrong thing. And he's very interested in the latest science and the latest studies of mental illness. While he's living in Philadelphia, we know the mental hospital there actually would admit visitors. You could pay admission, you could go gawk at the mental patients. So he was studying the mental patients. He was also reading up and finding out more about the science of mental health. And some of his stories, like The Fall of the House of Usher, have almost textbook descriptions of these mental conditions and of the latest phrenological terminology. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to make these as scientifically accurate and as realistic as possible. And that's one of the hallmarks, actually, of his horror and of his science fiction, because he's adding all these scientific details to make things seem like they're very plausible. So he had a great interest in science, and that probably contributed a lot to it. And there doesn't seem to be one particular event that would have made him interested in horror over comedy or detection. So there's all sorts of theories about why he was so interested in mysteries and why he would have invented the detective story, but it just seems to be the way his mind works. From early on, he's trying to solve mysteries. We know that even before he wrote his first detective story in The Murders in the Rue Morgue, years before that, while he was working the Southern Literary Messenger, he wrote an article about this new chess-playing automaton. And back then they had automatons that would travel the country, and you go see a show of dancing automatons or
now,
ones
what
that play
is
the
drum. Automaton?
It's kind of like a robot that you wind up, and usually, you know, there's singing ones and dancing ones and ones that play the drums. But this was an automaton that somehow could play chess, so it was a robot that played chess. And it apparently had played chess with Ben Franklin and Napoleon while it was in Europe. When it came to America, Poe got to see it in person. And he's trying to figure out, how does this automaton work? It looked from like a person from the waist up. It was attached to a table, and the table had the chessboard on it. And the table was in the form of a big box. And its opponent would sit in front of this box and play its pieces on the chessboard. And then the torso with the arms, it would move the chess piece on its side of the table. And what Poe figured out, he decided to do all the research he could into how this thing worked. And he proposed different theories, and he shot each of those theories down. So he used, well, deductive reasoning, or what he called ratiocination, to try to determine everything he could about this piece and try to figure out how it worked. And eventually he did figure out that it was just a guy hiding inside the box operating a puppet.
Wow. We are in the Raven Room at the Edgar Allan Poe Museum on Main Street in Richmond, talking with Chris Sempner, who is the curator of the Poe Museum. We're in the Raven Room. How does the Raven fit into his career? That's probably the poem that says Edgar Allan Poe more so than any other.
And that was his big hit, and he published that 4 years before his death. It was 1836. So he had struggled for a long time. He hadn't published a volume of his poetry in 14 years. So he had concentrated mostly on his essays and book reviews and short stories. And he'd written this new poem. He said he'd been working on it for the better part of a decade, but we don't know how much of that to believe. And he took it to Graham's Magazine, which is a place he'd edited at one point, and they turned it down. So they passed around a hat to collect money for him, and they collected $15 and paid him that, but didn't publish the poem. So eventually he took it to a political journal. So if it wasn't going to get into a literary magazine, at least he published in this political journal called the Whig Review, the American Whig Review. And they paid him $15, and he published it under a pseudonym, Quarles. He told one person that he did that because it was so bad he didn't want to risk ruining his reputation by putting his name on it.
He thought the Raven was bad poetry?
Well, actually, he contributed an introduction to the poem that said, among other things, that he didn't know that the English language was capable of such beauty before he read that poem. So he had confidence in it, but people didn't seem to respond to it the same way that he did, and he wasn't sure if it was a good move to publish this. But within the first week, as soon as it appeared in print in that magazine, it was reprinted in two other magazines under his name, and all of a sudden he was a household name, and then he was in demand as a lecturer traveling the country giving readings of his works. But they all wanted him to finish up The Raven. Little kids who recognize him on the streets follow him around going, "Nevermore, nevermore." He'd flap his arms like a big bird, and his nickname became The Raven. And you can read the letters that ladies wrote about him. They'd say things like, "The Raven has come in town to nest," and you know, they were talking about old Poe. And eventually he called that My Old Black Bird. He got sick of that one, and he really had to be encouraged to read it, but everybody wanted him to read it at their houses or give readings at their local concert hall. So it's the one that made his reputation, but he only got those $15 for it. And without really effective domestic copyright laws and really no international copyright law, it was reprinted in several different magazines, both in the United States and in Europe, and he became a hit overseas, too. And Elizabeth Barrett Browning actually wrote about how it created a stir in England. Poe had dedicated his book, The Raven, and other poems to her. And she wrote that she didn't know how she felt about having a book like that dedicated to her. But one person said that he read the poem, was afraid to go to his library at night. He had a bust of Pallas in his library. He was worried a raven's going to fly in the room and land on it if he went there at night.
We've got just a few minutes left, Chris, and time flies when we're talking about a subject this interesting. Poe's death came under very mysterious circumstances, and it was in Baltimore.
Yes.
Correct? What is the, and there have been so many stories, but what do you believe are the facts behind his death?
Well, we know he was in Richmond on the 26th of September, 1849. He's 40 years old. He's about to start his own literary magazine. He's found a financial backer for that. He's about to get married. His fiancée lived on Church Hill on East Grace Street, and he was visiting her that evening. And she said he had a fever and he was very sick, and she knew he was planning on going to Philadelphia the next day on business. He had a volume of poetry he was going to edit for somebody. He was going to get paid about $100 for about 2 days' work, so he thought that was a deal he couldn't pass up. Then he was going to go to New York, pick up his aunt, who was also his mother-in-law from his first marriage, and bring her down here, and he was going to marry his new fiancée on the 17th of October. So he had a lot of plans, a lot of things going on, and a month earlier, he had joined the Sons of Temperance and pledged never to touch alcohol again, and there were people in the group who made sure that he stayed true to his pledge. By this time, a glass of wine would make him staggering drunk and he'd be sick for days afterwards. So he knew to stay away from alcohol. So he was sick when he left his fiancée's house, and he went to a doctor's house, who was a friend of his, and the doctor advised him to stay here a few more days because he seemed to have a fever and seemed very ill. And Poe left anyway, and very early in the morning of September 27th, he caught a steamship from here to Baltimore and then disappeared for 5 days. So the first reliable evidence we have of what happened to him is 5 days later, there's a letter that exists that says there's a gentleman by the name of Poe who's a little worse for wear who needs your immediate assistance. And this was written to a fellow named Joseph Snodgrass. And Snodgrass was a magazine editor in Baltimore who'd known Poe, and he picked up Poe and offered to take him to his uncle's house. And Poe had an uncle, Henry Herring, who lived there. And Herring said, "I really don't want Poe at my house, so I don't really care what happens to him." So they sent Poe to the hospital. He spent 4 days there, delirious, in and out of consciousness, talking to shadows in the wall. At first, they just assumed, well, he'd been found at a polling place that's in a tavern. It's a voting day. Things get a little bit rowdy. Maybe he was just drunk. But then when he got to the hospital, they thought, well, he's dressed in somebody else's clothes that don't seem to fit him. He doesn't appear to have been drinking, doesn't smell of alcohol. They weren't sure what had happened to him. There was even a theory that maybe he was drugged and used as a repeat voter. It's a practice called cooping, and the Fourth Ward polls where he was found were notorious for cooping. But while he's in the hospital, they asked if he knew what had happened to his trunk of clothes, and he couldn't remember what had happened to that. He was asking if he had any friends who come and visit him. And he said that his friend would be whoever would take a pistol and blow out these wretched brains. But he kept saying he had a wife back in Richmond, had to get back to his wife. But he actually died 10 days before he would have married Elmira, the fiancé here in Richmond. And his last night on earth, he woke up in the middle of the night and screamed the name Reynolds over and over again. But we're not sure who Reynolds was. It wasn't a completely uncommon name, so there's a lot of candidates for who Reynolds could be. And finally he calmed down. His last words were, "Lord, help my poor soul." And the obituaries came out the next day. The newspapers were saying everything from he had died from a case of mania, a POTU, or maybe he'd had drugs or alcohol. Others said that he had congestion of the brain. And there's no surviving medical records of his death. There's no surviving death certificate. The best thing we have is a letter that Poe's attending physician wrote to his mother-in-law a month later, and that doesn't really help us much. He gives the symptoms, he describes Poe's final days, but instead of saying what killed Poe, he says, "By now you're well aware of the illness from which Mr. Poe suffered." So that doesn't help us much. And later, this doctor, whose name was John Moran, published a book saying that Poe died of nervous prostration, a loss of nerve power.
Hmm. medicine was not as refined in those days as it is now.
Yeah, so it could have been simple. It could have been just that he had the flu when he left Richmond. Maybe that explains the fever. Maybe that's why he was sick. We know it was raining when he was in Baltimore, so maybe he was soaking wet and he had to buy some cheap secondhand clothes just so he'd have dry clothes to wear. Or maybe he was beaten up and somebody stole his clothes. But they don't mention that he had a head trauma or anything. He could have, but they don't have any mention of it.
And he's buried in Baltimore.
Yep, buried in Baltimore. And only about 7 people attended the funeral. They buried him before they even announced it. So a lot of people didn't even know he was dead until after the funeral. And his fiancée here in Richmond didn't know until after the fact that he was dead. She lost touch with him for about a week, and she was anxious and worried. She just had this feeling that he was dead, and turns out she was correct. And he was buried in just an unmarked grave in a Poe family plot. And it wasn't until about 11 years later that they decided to get a monument, and some of his cousins got money to get a nice monument for him. And the shop where they carved these monuments was next to a train tracks, and a train jumped the tracks and smashed into the monument. Hmm. So he would have to wait even longer. He waited until about 26 years after his death until they finally got him a nice big monument. It was paid for by school children and teachers and people who were interested in Poe's works and fans of his who thought he deserved just the nicest monument in the whole cemetery, because he was America's first internationally influential writer who actually changed the face of world literature, inventing new different literary genres and inspiring European writers in a way that no American author had done before. So they got him this nice big monument. They buried his mother-in-law on one side, and they moved him across the cemetery to this new monument, which is going to be right next to the church gates. As they're moving him, the coffin fell apart. And the newspapers the next day describe in vivid detail what it was like seeing Poe's corpse and the bones and everything. And people grabbed chunks of the coffin, which are big collector's items now. But they buried him in the new spot on the new monument. They thought it would be a good idea to get his wife and bury her next to him. But his wife had died 2 years before he did, and she had died in the Bronx, so she was buried in the Bronx. And by this time, somebody had built over her cemetery and moved all the bodies. But Poe's most devoted fan ever, named William Gill, who had written an early biography of Poe, had personally saved the bones of Poe's wife, which he took home with him and kept under his bed for a little while in a little box. And eventually he was convinced that was a bad idea, and he gave up the bones, and now they're buried next to her husband.
An amazing man.
Yeah, an amazing man. And
amazing life.
Yeah, and his story keeps on going. If you followed the comic books, he actually joined forces with Batman to fight crime in a limited edition comic book called Batman Nevermore. Next month he's going to be in a movie called The Raven, where he's chasing down serial killers.
Wow.
So Poe's been dead since 1849, but he's still part of our everyday life, a part of our popular culture. He's been on The Simpsons 3 times already. They even did a Simpsons version of The Raven, where Bart's the Raven and Homer's the narrator.
Chris, I wish we could spend more time talking about this. He really was an amazing man, and he made quite an impact on American letters. We've been talking with Chris Sempner, who is the curator of the Edgar Allan Poe Museum on Main Street in Richmond, a place well worth a visit. I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.